Poet, scholar and translator John Balaban does not have what you would call the standard CV for a literary scholar. Born to Romanian immigrant parents in the projects of Philadelphia, he developed his love of words from his sisters singing pop tunes as there weren't any books in the house. During the Vietnam War, he was a conscientious objector who then went on to Vietnam to record the local oral poetry tradition before translating an 18th century Vietnamese poet and then going on to write 11 books, win numerous poetry prizes and become the president of the American Literary Translation Association. He's currently poet in residence and professor of English in North Carolina State University. John Balaban will be in Ireland next week as part of the Dunleary Mountains to the Sea Festival, and he joins me now. John, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You didn't exactly have a conventional upbringing for a delicately nurtured profession like poet.
Well, I think the real background is pretty unconventional for most poets. Mine was, as you said earlier, in a pretty rough housing project outside of Philadelphia. I think I might have been the first person from that area ever to go to college. Most of them went to the army or to jail, at least my childhood friends. So I went from there, and then I went after high school to work in a glue factory, and then I got myself into college on loans, and from there I went to Harvard, and from Harvard in graduate school I went to Vietnam, and I learned Vietnamese, and I found this incredible, alive, oral poetry tradition being sung in the countryside.
In terms of writing poems, though, this is something that you did at a fairly young age. I mean, you weren't even a teenager, I think, when you began writing.
No, I mean, I think that's part of the genetics. That's why I don't know that there's a particular background to being a poet. I think it's just something that's in your genes, and you respond to words in maybe in a different way, and you conjure words in a different way, and you hear things other people don't quite hear, even as a little kid, even if you're not aware of it, or even aware that it's poetry you're thinking about. So yeah, and I had good teachers. I was lucky that I had, as a little kid, I had teachers who saw what was happening with me and gave me books.
And to what extent were your sisters your teachers? Not necessarily overtly your teachers, but subliminally, were they teaching you something?
Well, every now and then I'm talking to my wife and I break out in a 1950s show tune. And she just looks at me with amazement, because I've never said anything about such things before, but they're all there, and I learned them from, I'd hang around my older sisters for want of anything else to do in the kitchen. They'd be drying dishes and singing these songs, and they stuck with me. And I think the music of those things and the cleverness of the lyrics, as good a poetry for a young kid as any other.
You've learned a lot of languages, I note, in your time, but many of them are languages that you wouldn't be able to go into a coffee bar and speak to other people, aren't they?
No, I think I maybe was in one place where I could speak Latin to anybody. And then I learned Old English. I learned that at Harvard, and I learned a little Greek along the way. Yeah, so I picked up languages, and I can't say I'm that good at it, but I struggle through it.
You also became a Quaker at the age of 16. Why did you make that decision?
Well, the place I grew up in was pretty bare and violent, and the Quakers, I grew up in an area of Philadelphia founded by Quakers, and I had a good friend in high school who belonged to an old Quaker family, and out of curiosity, I went with him one day to a Quaker meeting, and I stuck with it. Their quietude, their notion of an inner light, their disinterest in preachers, all that appealed to me.
And when exactly did the Vietnam War register on your horizon? That was after Harvard, was it?
No, prior. In college, when I had some friends go to a demonstration in Washington, they were bloodied, badly bloodied by the D.C. police. And as a result, they were radicalized, and I was more radicalized. So I went to Harvard on a fellowship, and I was just not going to let anything get in the way of graduating from Harvard. And I was enjoying. I was studying Old English, Middle Scots, things I utterly fascinated by. And I had fantastic teachers. So I tried to avoid the war, and the war was just too much there. And there was an event where Robert McNamara, then the Secretary of Defense, came and was blocked in an alley. And I had been walking home. I got behind the news team because it looked like trouble. They had him blocked in his car. And he was so arrogant and offensive in a kind of improper way that I volunteered. I wrote to my draft board a few days later and said I was volunteering to go to Vietnam. as a conscientious objector. They thought I was crazy.
I mean, you didn't have to do any of that. You were a student. You could have avoided the draft by dint of being a student. You could have gone to Canada.
Yeah, yeah, you know, they're very sweet about it. They reminded me of what you just said. You know, like, are you
crazy?
Are you crazy? And in fact, that was the only question at the hearing I had to have. But I went on my own terms. I went as in a voluntary group, sort of like the Peace Corps, and I taught, for a while anyway, linguistics at a Vietnamese university in the Mekong Delta. The place got bombed. I got wounded in the Tet Offensive. I came home, went back.
But how did, I mean, particularly when you then went back in 1971, 72 and started doing this sort of almost like Alan Lomax type field recordings, how did they respond to an American in their midst?
I was a very strange presence. I mean, here I wasn't in uniform. I was in my 20s, and I would be walking up, speaking Vietnamese, usually with somebody from the particular community I was in, and I would ask this question, would you sing me your favorite poem? And they did not think this was an odd thing at all. They thought the poetry was that important, and that it was finally, there was an American coming around bothering them about something worthwhile. I would try to think of a 20-year-old Vietnamese walking up to an American farmhouse, knocking on the farmhouse door and saying, would you sing me your favorite poem? And what he would get, right? And, you know, it wouldn't have worked out at all, but in Vietnam, it wasn't a strange proposition because this poetry has been sung for over 1,000 years, passed down by word of mouth, and there's a kind of wisdom in it that Vietnamese live by.
But when you recorded this poetry some of the tapes, some of the field tapes, you can actually hear gunshots in the background.
Yeah. Yeah, sometimes I recorded on an island in the Mekong River, and on one side of the river, actually on both sides, but on one in particular, there was always a lot of trouble at night in particular. And one night I was recording, and a firefight started up, gunshot, a mortar being dropped down, and then a lot of gunshot. Nobody even bothered to stop singing, so I just kept recording, looking over across the river a bit now and then, but we didn't stop.
And when then did you discover this 18th century poet, Ho Xuang Hung?
Yeah, Ho Xuang Hung lived around 1800. She probably was the most famous poet, certainly the most famous woman poet ever in Vietnam. And her poetry is known by heart even today. She was a bit naughty, so Vietnamese high school students, for instance, only find her proper poetry in their classrooms. The other stuff is saved for, I guess, when they grow up, I don't know. But she was so fast and quick that she could compose two poems at once in this very strict form, which the Chinese call lu shi, regulated verse, and made classical in the 8th century. And she was thought of as sort of like the fastest gun in the West. You know, people, young men in particular, would come and challenge her. You can gamble in Vietnamese on poetry, and you can win a political argument quoting a poem or coming back with a poem, and she simply could do that better than anybody.
And has translating her, has that influenced your own work? Because you are an exceptional poet in your own right. You've had 2 National Book Award nominations. You've written numerous books of poetry, a couple of novels as well. Has this work in the 1970s influenced how you approach your own writing?
It has. There's this huge regard for the cleverness of form in her poetry, but also in the folk poetry. In English, the comparable thing would be Gerard Manley Hopkins in Rove Rhyme. Even in the folk poetry, which is sung, there's this intricate rhyming and tonal music that's required by the form. And this is by people who can't read or write. So in the literary tradition, which Ho Xuan Hung worked in, it's even more intricate. And for Vietnamese, it wasn't intricate enough. There are Vietnamese poems, for instance, in this form, which begin as a poem in Vietnamese, rhyming all the way down, rhymes on the first, second, fourth, sixth, and eighth lines, always has the same number of syllables, syntactic parallel structure. You get to the last word, Miles, and then go backwards, and it's another poem, and it's in Chinese, not in Vietnamese. I might think about doing that.
That is,
it's about the same place, but a different point of view.
That is highly, highly intricate. John, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed for getting up early this morning and having this chat.
My pleasure.
And John Balaban appears at the Dunleary Mountains to the Sea Festival on Saturday, the 7th of September. That's on at 8 o'clock in the Maritime Museum in Dunleary. And it's worth going just to see the Maritime Museum, but also obviously worth going to listen to. John's a fantastic venue. More details on www.mountainstosea.ie.